Aaron Berg, welcome to How to Be Tom Shalhoub.
Hi, Tom. How do I become Tom Shalhoub?
Well, I think we'll know by the end, I think.
How to Be Tom Shalhoub. A podcast starring me, Tom Shalhoub. Each week, I explore a topic or speak with someone I find interesting, someone I think you could learn from. By listening, you might gain some insight into what it's like to be Tom Shalhoub. Now, why would anybody want to do that? Well, look, you have to model yourself after someone, right? Might as well be me. I mean, who are you going to be, Albert Einstein? Much easier to start with someone simple, like me. Tom Shalhoub.
Oh, this is really exciting. This, I've seen behind the curtain, if you may. I've only seen you usually on television. You're very made up. You're very prim and proper. And today I got to see you prepare for this. And your head was down, and I thought you were frozen, but you were clearly doing research for a few minutes. And I've never seen the top of your head like that.
So you could see me before I let you in the room?
That's correct.
That's weird. That's a flaw in my whole system.
Yeah, it's you should know about that flaw in case anything bad happens. That's how Tubin went down.
So you've got, is that your podcast set up right there?
It was intended to be my podcast setup, and then here's where I'm at right now. I'm going to confide in you. I'm over it. I've jumped the shark. I'm going to unplug from everything. I think all social media I'm going to unplug from. I think podcasts I'm done with. I do man on the street stuff. That's still fun, but I think that's it. I think I'm going to get rid of everything, but this is my base.
You're sick of basically. It.
I'm done, yeah. Tom. It's changed. I don't know if you're an old soul like me, but here's what I know about you. I once did a TV show that Jim Gaffigan had on TV Land. Do you remember it?
Yeah, his show, the Jim Gaffigan Show?
Jim Gaffigan Show. And the episode I was in, Adam Goldberg played his best friend, and he was like this bad boy comic, and he goes, "Who was your best friend when you first got to New York?" And Jim Gaffigan goes, "Tom Shalhoub." And he goes, "It wasn't me." And he goes, "No, it was Tom Shalhoub." And that, I always wondered if that was real or if he just put that in the script.
Yeah, no, it was real. And we were the first, I think in that episode, he didn't say who was your best friend. He said, who was the first comic you met in New York? And he said, Tom Shalhoub.
Really?
Who was your first comic friend in New York?
That's what it was. Like who was your first comic friend?
Yeah, because we met at Cold Waters, which was the original back when. Do you remember Hamburger Harry's?
No.
Well, Gladys's comedy room.
She then used to have a thing at the comic strip. She was like a really old lady that would have young comics on.
Yeah. So Gladys, back in like, I guess, 1991, she had her first comedy room was Cold Waters, which was a bar on the east side. And in the basement, she ran a comedy club and she had a weekly contest. And so you'd come and then you could all compete to win the, you know, kind of open mic prize or something like that. And yeah. Jim was there. I showed up to do it because it was in Backstage Magazine. I circled it. I went to Cold Waters and then you had to pay $5 because you had to get a drink. So yeah. It was basically like, okay, $5. And I got a drink at the bar. And then we all did like 3 minutes of stand up and this guy got up. And he was like kind of mumbly and had glasses and he was just reading out of his notebook. And I was like, oh, this guy's funny, you know? And then I went up to him afterwards and I was like, hey, you're good. And he was like, oh, you're good. I saw you. And he was like, I said, so, you know, you're a comedian. He said, well, I work at Gray Advertising, but you know, I'm running around doing this at night. And he said, I can't even believe I'm doing this. He said, I went to Georgetown, you know, like he was just kind of like, and so I said, oh, this guy's great. So I took his number down. And he said, oh, I'll help you find the open mic nights around town because he was already doing the circuit. So that's how that was my first contact was him. And he was I always reminded him that he was very friendly, even though he has a reputation as being, you know, years later, people thought Gaffigan, he would just come in and he would kind of keep to himself. And so when I would tell that story, people would say, oh, Jim, he was that friendly. And I mean, he actually came up to me.
Wow.
You know,
Jim's always been very friendly to me.
Yeah.
Like I met him at, and I don't want to make this all about obviously the Jim Gaffigan podcast, but it was like, I met him at Eastville Comedy Club and he was so outgoing and nice. And when I'm an immigrant, I moved here from Canada. So to get my green card, I needed like big time celebrities to sign off, and Gaffigan signed off and like had a letter written for me and everything. Like Aaron Berg's an extraordinary talent. You know, he lied, but it was it worked out really well. And I still see him.
That's incredible. Okay, so let's go to that, your immigration experience, because I didn't even know that you were Canadian until I did a quick, you know, I thought I better, you know, I barely know the real Aaron Berg story, so I better like look it up here. So I just looked up quickly on your website, and then, you know, so Canada, and then you did get your immigration. What is it? Naturalization? What did you do? You became a citizen? What are you?
Not easy. Oh boy, it's a long road. Here's the preparation of it.
Yeah.
You first in Canada, everyone's trying to get out. Because if you do stand up, there's just a real ceiling as to where you could go. And I'm a bluer comic. So there was really a ceiling where you could go. You know, there's like a couple major networks, CBC, CTV, they wouldn't touch you if you were dirty. So you had to stir up enough noise that publications would write about you. So the newspapers would be like, who's this guy? And I had a job years ago. I worked as a male stripper for a summer. So I had that, and I turned that into a one-man show.
I thought that was a joke. You did.
That's a real thing. Yeah. And it came from like a middle-class family. My mother was horrified, to say the least. And her and my aunt came one night, didn't announce that they were coming to watch me strip. And my mom was just like so Jewish. And she's like, you're very good at what you do. You're very talented. You're better than the other guys. There was one guy that was, I don't want to say, but he has certain talents, but your talents were very good. The talents that you had.
Was it like a Chippendale type of show? Like, yeah,
it was
whole
called
review?
Fantasy Male Review. It was like on the, it rode the coattails of Chippendales. It was the premier exotic entertainment destination in Toronto at the time. And it was
wow. So a lot of ladies go, like the, you know, the bachelorette parties and things like that, right?
Crazy, Tom. Standing room only, 350 people. I remember the biggest celeb to ever walk in was Christina Applegate. This was like she was there shooting a movie, I think, at the time. I don't know if that's throwing her under the bus or not. What am I, Joe Coy with his writers? Okay, so I did this stripping thing, which was one of the greatest times of my life, because I jumped around. I got an honors degree in philosophy. I didn't know what to do. I then started bodybuilding after a bad breakup, and then I was like,
wait,
okay,
bodybuilding after male stripper?
Bodybuilding before. You can't.
Okay, I was going to say, that's like that probably what drove it, right? Because you have to be kind of a muscle man to be the male stripper.
That's how I got into it. It was, I'm either going to be a bouncer or a stripper, and I'm 5'5" and a little bit. So I wasn't a really good bouncer. I would literally just sit there and read like Nietzsche on the bar stool while people would come in. They'd be like, ID, please. And they'd be like, oh, he's so intellectual. He'd never fight. I tried to throw that vibe out. And then I was like, I could do this. I worked out at this gym, and there was a couple guys in Toronto that did the same thing. And they're like, yeah, dude, if you want to try it, go try it. And there was a newspaper ad, same as you found the open mic. It was like looking for male exotic dancers. And I went to an office, and he's like, yeah, I got a gig for you. I'll let you know what comes up. And then he sent me to a bar in the middle of Ontario, like a 2-hour drive. And I did it for the first time. I bought a construction worker outfit. I had no idea what I was doing. And I went on stage and I kind of fumbled through it. And then I got good enough at it that, you know, within 6-8 months, I was at this good club. And then it was a dream come true. There was no way out, by the way. There's no top. You know, there was like, what am I aspiring to? There's Thunder Down Under, which is in Vegas, which those guys make a good living. that was barely around. And there was a place called Le Bear in Dallas, Texas. And there'd been rumors about one guy that left Toronto and went to Dallas. And now he's making $4,000 cash a night. And his name is Rocco. And he got a Mercedes. And that was the highest that you could aspire to. And there was one guy that was on a TV show called Catwalk in Toronto. But there was no way out. Once you got in, you're like, oh, I better figure this better be for a short time and then get out. So I did it for 2 years.
So how many times a week do you have to do the show?
You would strip five shows a week. I think we were closed Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday. You were open Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and some Sundays.
And like, was it a one show a night or to have like an eight?
Sometimes two.
Yeah.
And the first show you would keep on a G string. The second show you would not. And unfortunately, that was the show my mom came to.
So you were a construction worker. And then were there other guys like the other kind of like the village people?
I couldn't be the construction. When I tried to travel with the construction worker, they're like, nah, you can't do that. Tony's the construction worker. You can't be the construction worker. Like it was a hack bit. So yeah. you had to change it. So I finally bought a cowboy costume off this guy named Braveheart. He was retiring. He's like, I'm out of the game. I'll sell you my costume for $300. And then I had that. And then luckily there was so many good cowboy songs at the time. Cotton Eyed Joe, Desperado. Oh, it was a litany. Literally, Tom, I'd walk out, that old would play. The lights had come down. I had a cap gun on my holster. And the lights are out. And then I'd shoot it. And then Thank God I'm a Country Boy came on by John Denver. Cotton Eyed Joe, and then Desperado. And then if I was doing the shower song, I'd throw on an extra slow song.
Wanted Dead or Alive. What does that mean?
There was a shower on stage.
Oh,
we could go in the shower. And one time, a woman that I went to high school with, who then became a police officer in Toronto, came in, violently groped me while I was in the shower. And we had a female bouncer. The female bouncer took this lady, who is a cop, threw her down the stairs. This stuff never happens anymore.
Wow.
Yeah.
And so how much money would you make? What do you make for a show? And then is it like with a stripper, with like girls, I think it's like all tips, right? But is yours just like a show
business? You've heard through the grapevine that's how it works?
Yeah. Yeah.
You would get, yeah, there was no, there was show pay. I think there was a point where it was maybe $75 a show for your stage show. And then the rest was tips.
Oh,
so
wow.
On a really good night. And bear in mind, I was not good. I was not a good stripper. There's nothing. I'm not a sexy guy. I'm a funny guy. So that's how I started making money. Like I'd go around and be like, hey, ladies have shots. Huh? I'd drink their drinks and stuff.
Yeah.
Like, what are you doing? I'm like, it's mine. Just trying to be like aggressive.
Yeah.
But some good nights, and I'm talking odd, $700-$800 you'd walk out with, and you'd be like, oh, this is great. Bad nights, and I'm not exaggerating, $3 or $4. Dollars. And Canadian coins, Tom. You're leaving with coins. Dollar coins.
Okay, so it wasn't a lucrative venture.
No.
Yeah.
But it's then that made me become a personal trainer. That's how I got out of that, because I was in good shape. So it's like, okay, I can be a personal trainer now.
Yeah.
And that got me out. And then I started doing stand-up, and I took this stuff, plucked it for the stand-up, and started making long-form stories out of it. And that's how I made noise in Toronto, to our original point where I could get that press. Like newspapers would write about me. He's provocative. He's doing these stories. And it was all very Toronto-centric stories. You get that press. Then you have to get people to sign off. Then you need a manager in America. Then at that point, you get an O-1 visa. Do you know what that is?
No.
Extraordinary talent.
Yeah.
So I was the best, we were saying, at, you know, blue comedy. So it was like, in the great history, you have to write these grandiose letters. In the great history of Lenny Bruce and George Carlin and Sam Kinison and Richard Pryor. And then came this small town Jewish boy. So it was that type of vibe. I got an L1. Then I was able to move to New York. So I gave up everything I had in Canada. I was already a headliner, making six figures a year, barely. but doing, I had a decent life in Canada. Moved to a bedroom in Astoria, like a 6x8 bedroom with cockroaches and like four other comics. Yeah. And at that point, then you're trying to get a green card. So off that O-1 visa, so I've got a manager. I go out, I audition for Law and Order. Great role. It was Gay Cruiser number 2. And I was down on the pier. This is the essence of the role. And they're like, what's going on down here? I'm like, why don't you get out of here? This is our orgy. Like, it was that type of thing. And Law and Order, if you know this, they call right away. So I did the audition. My manager called half an hour later. You just booked Law and Order. It was three lines. I'm like, oh my God.
Was it SVU or would the...
No, this was original Law and Order.
Yeah, yeah.
This is the real deal. And I don't know how to turn that off. The thing is beeping. I'm sorry. So
I
then,
don't hear it.
Okay, good. Nothing's happening then. So I'm like, this is great. And he goes, they just need your paperwork. So we send it in. They're like, oh, he can't do it. He has an O-1 visa. You can't do TV and film with an O-1 visa.
Oh.
So my get on Law & Order. So then years later, and I'm telling you, Tom, maybe $30,000 invested. I get a green card finally. And then 5 years after my green card, like a year and a half ago, I got my citizenship. And I went to Newark and did the test and everything. And
unbelievable.
And this was just post COVID. So they're like, okay, you pass. I got I went 6 for 6. I knew them back and forth. And then they go, okay. And I'm like, oh, this is great. I'm going to go home and tell my wife. And they're like, no, there's a ceremony right now. Because it was like, because it was after COVID, they were just moving everything along.
Yeah.
So I went in, they gave me like a little paper flag and I told my wife, I'm like, they're doing it now. She's like, I can't get there. So I'm on FaceTime, I'm doing it. And I started tearing up a little bit. It was it's a really important thing. I don't know why, but immigrants really love America.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very emotional experience, I would imagine. It's, you know, it's kind of like, you know, the best Catholics, they're converts, you know?
Yeah.
They know, they're the ones who can quote the catechism back to you because they learned it and they wanted to learn it. And, you know, so that's what it is. You're a convert. You're an American convert.
Yeah, and hardcore. Like, I'm all in. It's all, you know... Luke Combs, Dodge Rams, Second Amendment, First Amendment, like hardcore. Like I went all the way, and people are like, what happened to you? You know? And it was just because there's such a love for it. And I grew up on an America, the America that was really glamorized was 80s America, right? Like it was like Reaganomics, trickle-down theory, excess, Hollywood, bigger, better, badder, louder. That's the type of America that you move here, not necessarily expecting, but that's what you know the promise is. You know, the American dream. It's Scarface, you know? It's like you can move here with nothing and then have everything and then get shot in your foyer.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's interesting. There are so many Canadians who kind of came here and they became, you know, whoever. Take Michael J. Fox or all the, you know, all the famous, you know, the Second City people and things like that. They all had to have some version of that journey, right? They had to be invited by someone. They had to get the O-1. They had to get the green card, that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's not easy. I mean, I mentioned it on stage and it's a joke that's kind of hit and miss right now. And I go, like, it's really not easy to come to America unless you come in through Texas, then you get a whole bunch of money in a hotel room. But it's like one of those things that's like not hitting most of the time now. And I'm like, oh, I guess it's just too true because when people turn on the news, that's what they see. Like if you're driving and you're listening to Fox around midnight, which is when I'm usually coming home from spots, that whole segment around midnight is like trouble at the southern border. And it's day in, day out. It just seems like that's what's on all the time.
Well, doesn't it fill you with rage that that's the case? I mean, that you have, you know, this is the thing they talk about all the time. Whenever these people end up having hearings or if you have a politician giving a speech about it and they talk about people who came the real way, you know, people who came the legal way must have the most resentment, including Hispanics, which is why I think there are a lot of Hispanics, as in Hispanic voters, because those are the ones who have, you know, become either citizens or they have green cards here. They did immigrate to the U.S. in the right way, whether it was through the family, connections, or whether it was through an employer. And they must resent the fact that there's caravans coming over and no one is doing it the right way.
Yeah, I think originally there was that, like, I was angry about it. And it was like, this was around the time, this was what, the 2016 election. So it was a real hot button topic at the time. And everybody was like, oh, you as an immigrant, you must really feel like you must really hate the Republican side because you're so pro-immigrant. And I was like, no, I'm pro-legal immigrant. So that I remember arguing over that with several people and actually like losing a friend or two over that. But now I think there's a kinder part of me where I'm like, I get it. Like, I get that they have to come here. But you look at what's happening in New York, where it's like, oh, we finally got somewhere. Oh, we're being shipped to New York. Okay, I guess we're in New York. And now they're like, get out of New York. And it's like, this seems, they probably would have just stayed home rather than have to go through New York and send their kids to public school in New York.
Yeah, well, I also think that even if you were someone who said, oh, you got to open the border as much as, you know, the people who want a liquid border, they say, don't worry, these people are going to come, they're going to work. And then, as soon as there's no work, they're going to go back, you know, but I don't think that's really the case, because it doesn't seem to me, obviously, in the Northeast, that there's any kind of ability to have any job base for the amount of people who are coming, because all you got to do is walk to Grand Central from, you know, when I leave work and I walk to Grand Central, I go by the Roosevelt Hotel and there's just spilling out of the hotel into the streets and, none of them can find work.
Yeah. This is not just exclusively an American issue. Like, I know Canada has this problem now too, where the hotels are overflowing with migrants that just ended up. Can you imagine you moved to live the American dream and you're in Regina, Saskatchewan? Like, it seems like a nightmare to me. I don't think that they would move back. And I also think that the American system is a pretty good one, for lack of a better word, to leech off of if you're kind of hanging on to. Look, when I had no money, and I'm not ashamed to say, I had like Obamacare. Like, when I first moved here, I had health, yep. And I'm telling you, my health care was never cheaper. Like, we have good insurance now and it's through the roof. But I had a card, everything was free. I remember I'd have a mole and I'd go and be like, hey, I got this mole. Can you, there you go.
And now, why was that? Like, you had a poverty, you passed some kind of threshold and then they
yeah, really- it was so poor. I had like basic, I don't know if it was called Medicaid or Medicare. It was one of those things where it was like, your health insurance is free on the government.
Yeah. Although isn't Canada, if one is into, government expenditures, isn't Canada much more so? Like, don't they have the whole nationalized health care?
Yeah, but I'll tell you what scares me now is now that they have like the assisted suicide. So I picture you just go in and be like, I got a real bad cavity. And they're like, have you tried assisted suicide?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, they're passionate about death in that there's something very grim about the. I'm totally anti assisted suicide. I think that the medical establishment is completely ridiculous. I'm absolutely against it, but they are going down the path of being a very, it's going to be a very dangerous and grim operation.
It's a really weird country to be from and growing up there when it was a different thing. And I also notice this now, whenever I meet Canadians in New York, like if I'm at Broadway Comedy Club, they get so many tourists there. All those Canadians are very right wing now, which is shocking because most people think of Canada as this socialist country and you don't know about the blowback that happens there. But whenever I go back, nobody up there likes the prime minister. Nobody likes any of the policies. Nobody likes anything. Like there is a real right wing, not even a fringe anymore. Like it almost seems like a majority up there that's taken over, but there's so many liberal people, but then you see this other side and they're very local. Like I remember seeing that trucker convoy that happened up there like a year ago. And that was a real awakening of it. And, you know, most Canadians are very docile and quiet. And I think that, I think COVID woke a lot of people up and it's interesting to see what's going to happen up there, but it's also a scary place.
Well, Jordan Peterson, you know, and you got obviously Rebel News. I think, I don't know how big they are, but I pay attention to them all the time, and they have, are they the biggest right wing?
I think that they were. I watched them for a little bit a couple years ago, but yeah, I talked to someone. I was doing my man on the street up there. I went up and did shows in Toronto 3 weeks ago. And the guy that shot my man on the street, he's like, Jordan Peterson was my professor before he got fired. And I go, what was he like? And he's like, everyone loved him. He was brilliant. He was funny. And it was this thing. And he's like, I think he's a little messed up now, but I don't know what's going on. But it's amazing to watch how these people have this build up into what gets them to that point where all of a sudden they're like, well, this guy's gone way too far. You know, there has to be a buildup to whatever it was he said that put him past that threshold.
Absolutely. And they fired him for it. I mean, he was essentially, he was the classic guy who said, I'm not going to say it. Like when he was doing the pronouns, I'm not going to say them. And then
that's a really good impression.
Yeah. Well, he became, you know, just with that refusal to say pronouns, he became a celebrity just from that.
Yeah. The educational system, when we went, where'd you go to school?
In Boston, Norwood, Massachusetts.
I went, it was meant to awaken the mind and to show different perspectives. And I don't know if it's now because we're just older. And a lot of the thoughts that I have is like, is this just us shaking our fist at rock and roll when we look at stuff like that? You know what I mean? Like, these kids, they don't get, but it seems like these thoughts are so mainstream. Like I look at what happened at Rutgers and what happened at all the high-end institutions and, you know, Claudine Gay stepping down. And it's like, it seems like these schools aren't rebellious anymore, that they don't fight against mainstream thought, that they're just really encapsulated in mainstream thought.
Interesting is that because I went to school and, you know, a couple of different schools in Boston. I was at Emerson and then I went to UMass Boston, but I lived in Somerville, you know, just on the border of Cambridge. And I was in Harvard Square almost every day because, you know, we were just a short walk from there. And we used to perform in Harvard Square, street perform, you know, we'd sing a cappella music and stuff like that. And one time I was singing Barbershop at Harvard. Now, this was 1986. And we're singing Barbershop at Harvard in Harvard Square there. And people are throwing money in the hat. And there was this woman with a shaved head, and she was standing in our way, like getting in front of the barbershop quartet. And she was saying, these white males are using their privilege. And, you know, I was like, she was way ahead of her time.
In 86.
86. Yeah. And she was saying white male privilege. And she was saying, and I kept thinking like, oh, well, this woman's just nuts. Like nobody thinks like this woman, but she was what a sign of things to come.
It's amazing when you look back and see those things. There was a comic I used to work with in Toronto, really edgy guy, and he would help all the amateurs come up, and really not likable, real mean, but real genius comic mind. And I remember years ago him being like, I love trans women. And everyone's like, this guy's nuts. And then sure enough, like 20 years later, it's all the rage all over the world.
So we've got, you mentioned at the beginning, it was funny because I was like, was going to ask about your exhaustion level because you're the kind of comic that, you know, I'm like, you know, I work for Fox News now. So it's like, it's such a more cushy existence than I used to have. I used to live in the city on 56th Street and then I'd run around and I had to be doing spots at all times, even though I was making most of my living doing advertising, you know, commercials and voiceovers and whatever, you know, other kind of TV work I could scramble. But still, I was a comic. So I was like in the clubs every night and I was just trying to do my thing. But I was never I was kind of like, I'm not that closer kind of guy. Like you're the kind of comic. It's like, bring them in at the end, rock the room, slay them. You know what I mean? It's exhausting. Like that would have been exhausting for me in 1998, but that's kind of your thing, right? Are you still doing that? Are you still coming in and closing the room late at night?
Yeah. That was always my goal, was to be like, I want to be the guy that no one wants to go on afterwards, which I am. And now it's a problem because it's like, you don't want to be out that late all the time. So now I'll do like the earlier shows. And there's a difference. If I go up early on a show, if I have to swap spots when I'm meant to close out, I will do less well than I would at, because once they're real loose, then they're great for me. But there's some clubs I had to stop working because they were like, no one can follow you. You have to go on last. I'm like, but I'm jumping around. I have eight spots that night. Can you move me to 8:45 instead of 9:15? They're like, I can't do it. Yeah. Some clubs just would not let me do it.
Yeah.
And yeah, it's tiring. Tom, it's tiring. I've been doing it 23 years, almost every night. You know, I'll take one or two nights off a week now, but it's exhausting. And then you watch guys, friends of yours that are making millions and millions of dollars, and they only have to do like two or three shows a week, you know? And it's like they're doing arenas or they're doing huge theaters. And you're like, well, I'd like to do that and stay home more often.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and then for that period, I mean, there was about, I guess not even a decade, but, you know, probably 7 or 8 years where I was just touring with Gaffigan. And so that was my main stand-up income. So I was still doing, you know, voiceovers and commercials and things like that. But then I would go on the road with Jim for 8 weeks in the summer and then just do all these gigs and then come back. And then it was like, oh, now I can relax for 2 months, you know. So it was a pretty cushy having that kind of opening act it's very limiting in some way because you're kind of stuck in this role. You know, I was doing 13 minutes every night in these big, huge theaters, but it was great because you got a huge, great audience. But
and you're hanging out with Gaffigan, you're eating nice, you're staying in nice hotels. Yeah, it's great.
Very cushy and excellent. And then, you know, as I've got daughters and then Jim's family was growing, we would go together to Vegas. We would stay at the Mirage and then we'd go out to dinner together with the whole family. It was a total blast.
Yeah.
But the gigs, like when you go on the road, I noticed, I just went on your website and then it was like, I forget which gigs, but you were like, these dates are, you know, both shows are sold out, whether it was, I don't know if it was San Francisco or some, maybe it was Canada.
Probably Miami, I think.
Miami, so. The Miami show. Yeah, you were like, the Miami shows are sold out. So what do you do when you go to Miami? How do you sell out a show? Like, do you just blast on your social media?
I think I'm just lucky. And the club that I do in Miami, it's a smaller club, but I do it often. Believe me, I don't sell out often. So it's like, that's a good feeling. But it's the rest of the time, it's not like that. I'm still building, which is so weird because I'm 23 years in. So it'll be like, I did Dayton, Ohio last year. And I'm like, oh, these numbers are awful. And then I went back to Dayton and they're like, hey, you doubled your numbers. And I'm like, oh, these are still awful. And then I bumped into Chris DiStefano at the airport when I got back. And he's right behind me. And he goes, how's it going? I go, I just got back from Dayton. I doubled my numbers. I didn't even want to ask him where he was because, you know, it was somewhere great.
Yeah.
And he's like, so progress, you're making progress. And I was like, yeah. And then we talked about, you know. It's not all about, you know, it's not all about money. I think we forget how important the art of it is and how important the craft of it is. I know I'm guilty of forgetting that a lot. And here's what I'm going to do. Here's what there hasn't been for a long time. Do you remember when we were younger, there was underground sensations where people are like, oh my God, you got to hear this guy.
Yeah.
You got to hear this band. They're so cool. And it was this thing. Stanhope had it for a little bit. Doug Stanhope would just go around town, just do a bar, sell out a bar. There'd be a lineup of people to watch Stanhope. And everyone that knew Stanhope knew how great and brilliant Doug Stanhope was. But most people had never heard of Doug Stanhope. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to become an underground sensation. Yeah. I'm not going to try and go viral anymore. I'm not going to spend all my time on social media. I'm going to write and create stuff that I really want to do, that I really think is cool, and just do it and just hope magic happens. I think that happens when you make really cool art, magic happens. And it doesn't, I'm so shadow banned on Instagram. I can't get anything out on there. So it's like, I'm just going to do it. Do the work and see what happens.
And so you're going to take it easy with the podcast and everything, but are you doing other guys' podcasts? I would assume if, like, you know, you go on DiStefano's podcast or you're going like Tim Dillon or something like that. Like,
yeah,
that's a great way to sell tickets, right?
Yeah. I think that's a good way to sell tickets, but I also think it's like, you want to make your own thing. And I also think this model that everyone's trying to follow, it's too much of a blueprint. And it's, you know, I got into this to be different and to rebel. That's why I started doing the stand-up I was doing, because no one was doing, nobody was telling stories about when they were a stripper. And now it's just like, you know, everybody's got a little Nas X joke or something like that. So I'm just gonna try and do what I do and see where it lands, you know, because I'm failing at the other thing. I'm failing at the social media thing and I'm doing okay, but it's like, I'll get something that pops. And then I put a picture of Osama bin Laden on Instagram. And I was like, they found the guy that blew up the peace bridge. I thought it was a great joke and they took it. And I'm like, who takes this down? And then someone explained to me, they're like, it's not a person, Aaron. It is a computer that sees a picture of Osama bin Laden and they associate it with terror. And then they associate you with terror. So they take it down. I'm like, I got to find out who this guy is. It's not a guy. Yeah.
Exactly. Well, I've never been good at social media. I'm not good at podcasting. I don't know how many listeners I have, but I just do this because, like, once a week, it's a nice thing to do. It gets me talking to people. It's, I find it interesting. The joke is, you know, how to be Tom Shalhoub. It's kind of like, you know, why not? I mean, we got to be somebody, right? I mean, it's like, you know, who would want to listen to a podcast by Tom Shalhoub? It's very presumptuous. So I kind of want to take that as a tongue-in-cheek idea. I think anybody who does podcasting, it's like, it is a little bit silly, right? Because we're all just pretending that we're in our own little broadcast, like we're all playing here. But, you know, I'm not good at it. I don't think it, I've never had much luck using it to sell tickets. When I have a show, I'll do the social media. It makes people aware of it. But unless I go on Gutfeld and plug the dates, they're probably not going to sell out, you know, that kind of thing. So you always need kind of something. And lately, my thing is early. I do 4 o'clock shows, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock. That Fox News audience, they want to come. They come to the show. I've been doing a solo show now, which is a show I wrote about my dad. And so it's basically they can come at 4 or 5 o'clock. The show's done by either, you know, 6 or 6:30, and then they can go to dinner or go home.
That's great.
Yeah. And so it's and
you painless. Work clean, right?
Yeah, it's totally clean. And the show is, you know, I mean, I'm Catholic. I have a Catholic audience, essentially, you know, in some ways. Sometimes I do the show and it's, you know, Fox News audience and then maybe the Catholic community that word of mouth got around.
That's great.
So, it's totally clean. And, you know,
early's good for clean.
Yeah. Yes.
Late is good for dirty. Cause you associate late and a basement and this Mike Wilmot is this great Canadian comic. And he would always be, he's like this old dirty uncle that's telling stories in a basement and all the kids are asleep and now we're going to talk about all this horrible stuff. And it was, he really encapsulated it so well. I think it is. I think it's great that you're doing early shows. There's, you go around the country, there's people doing shows at 3, 4 o'clock, and you're like, how are these? And they're sold out. There's a guy, Henry Cho.
He does early too. Okay.
Yeah. It's crazy. It's great. Yeah.
Well, look, I think everything's great. And I think you have, you continue to have a bright future, Aaron. I mean, you have you done any shows? Any Fox shows or anything? Because I've asked for you a few times.
Yeah, I've Fox News Saturday Night. I got another episode coming up very soon.
Yeah, and, well, that was it. When I happened to be hosting it, you had already done it, and I was like, I want Aaron. Oh no, he already did it. So, and now it's going to be Jimmy doing all of them now. So you're going to be on with Jimmy.
Yeah, it's going to be great. Yeah, and I do Jimmy's radio show sometimes as well. Fox Across America.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. This is good chat.
Such a pleasure, man. This is a real bucket list thing for me. So it's such a pleasure to talk to you, and it's really cool that I found out what it's like to be Tom Shalhoub.
Yeah, that's great. Well, hopefully I'll get you on something on Fox. You know, I'm always doing things, but everything I do at Fox, then like it goes away. You know, so I had a show on a daily show on Fox Nation. I'm sure I'm going to have my own show on Fox Nation or on the network at some point. But Gutfeld keeps me busy. But next time I'm hosting something, maybe my Fox Nation show, then we'll have you on.
I would love to. Anytime. I'm at your beck and call. Thank you so much for having me, Tom.
Thank you. We'll see you
soon. Appreciate it. Bye-bye.